The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 148.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, guys. Welcome to today's live stream. I'm right here at the Red Pill Expo in Jekyll Island, where the Fed was created. It's actually a very pretty place. It's right on the beach, but G. Edward Griffin invited me here. Great, great guy. I've really enjoyed meeting him and his family, and got a lot of awesome speakers. My great friends, Robert and Kim Kiyosaki, are here as well speaking. I was able to speak yesterday. I'm not sure if they're going to put that up on YouTube or not. When I find out, I'll let you know. I did about a 45-minute presentation on the Great Reset and how to maybe structure your portfolio to take advantage of what Klaus and all of his cronies at the World Economic Forum have in store, what their crazy, crazy agenda is. But so let me dive into some questions here. I want to remind everyone, Rebel Capitalist Pro, this Tuesday night, we're doing a live stream with Miss Lynn Alden herself. I'm going to hop on there. We're going to answer member questions. So if you haven't checked out Rebel Capitalist Pro, make sure you do it. Make sure you do so, because especially going into the election right now, we're going through some crazy times where absolutely anything could happen. And you got to have your portfolio aligned for the most probable outcome. And so check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. That's the membership site, the investment membership site I have with Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. You can go to georgegammon.com/pro. So now let's dive into the questions. We had kind of an impromptu live stream today because I didn't know if I'd have time to pull it off, but I'm just here at the convention center. I was able to sneak away and knock this out. So we've got Daniel, have you watched Robert Kent's or Kent's on YouTube? He covers the IMF government plan. I've not seen him. I'll definitely try to check it out and see if he'd be a great person to interview on the Rebel Capitalist Show. Oh, by the way, guys, I don't know if you saw it, but Mike Maloney was nice enough to give me a shout out on one of his videos last week. And obviously, I'm a huge fan of Mike. I got a ton of respect for him. He's one of the guys that I've been watching since I got involved with this when I retired in 2012. So he's been instrumental to me kind of seeing the light in my macroeconomic journey. So I really want to say thank you to Mike for giving me that shout out on his video. Very, very kind of him. And I reached out to him on Twitter, and he said he's more than happy to do an interview for the Rebel Capitalist Show. So stay tuned. We got some incredible people coming up on the Rebel Capitalist Show. And oh, by the way, one of them might be Jim Rickards. So I'm not going to say for sure, but it might be. Definitely got Mike coming up. Okay, next question is it possible they can inflate the bubble even bigger? Absolutely, Brady. Sure. Why not? I used the Buffett indicator as an example of how overpriced the stock market is right now. We've got the market cap to GDP. I mean, it's going completely different directions. GDP has fallen off a cliff, and the market cap is going parabolic. And it's the only time I've seen in the chart going back to the 1970s where that's actually happened. So the market isn't just expensive now. It's the most expensive it has ever been relative to GDP. And that just shows you that there's no correlation whatsoever to the economy, the real economy, and the financial economy and the stock market. So I don't want to buy it because I like to buy things when they're cheap. And there's nothing cheap right now about the broad stock market. But that's not to say that through money printing or who knows how they can inject currency units into the system to create velocity. You know, we've talked about a Fed coin. I tweeted out just the other day about the Banking for All Act that pretty much outlines the digital dollar and everyone having a digital wallet and an account with one of the Federal Reserve banks. And this is how they could increase velocity. And who knows, a lot of that money, you never know where it goes. It might go into the stock market. We might, you know, I don't know where the S&P is right now, but it could double, triple, who knows? But then keep in mind too, it could also just go up in nominal terms. And we should be concerned with how it goes up adjusted for inflation, right? I used this as an example the other day. I think when I was speaking, and that if you have a $100,000 home and it goes up, let's say the price goes to $110,000, you didn't necessarily increase your purchasing power. If we had a 20% inflation rate, you actually lost purchasing power, even though the nominal price went up. So we have to have a deleveraging. It's just a matter of if the deleveraging is going to be a 1930s type of deflation or an inflationary deleveraging. So you can have, you can lose purchasing power even though the nominal price is going up on your assets. That's what I'm trying to get at. And so we could definitely, Venezuela is a great example of that, by the way. The stock market goes to all-time highs, but obviously you wouldn't want to own Venezuelan stock. Your purchasing power would go down. So it's definitely possible. That's what I'm trying to get at. Let's see. Okay, Daniel, you've already asked a question, so we'll try to get to someone who hasn't asked one. Hello from Sweden. When will you have Diego Perea from Quadriga, Tavia Costa, and Tomas Mullinen? So I've heard of Diego. I've heard him on, I believe, Macro Voices. Either Macro Voices or Real Vision or both. So I'd be open to having him on. Tavia, yes, I've heard of him on Twitter, but I haven't really gone into his content very much. And Tomas, I haven't gone into his content either. So I'd have to get into their content a little bit to see kind of what they're all about. Obviously, I'm more than receptive to talking to anyone who, you know, is kind of intellectually curious about this macro space. So I appreciate the suggestions, and we'll check them out. And guys, make sure you start with the word question. Helps me see them a lot easier. What do you think about oil stocks of the channel? Well, I mean, I think oil is great, but I like it based on my chart. I look at a long-term chart of oil. I think it goes back to at least 1940, the chart I usually use. But it's adjusted for inflation, and you see that when oil gets under $30 a barrel, it's cheap. When it gets over $80 a barrel, it starts to get expensive. So those are kind of, just keeping it simple, those are my lines in the sand, where if it's under 30 or getting towards 30, I'm more interested. And then I just don't pay any attention to it until it gets over 80. And then I start maybe consider selling. So I don't know where gold, or excuse me, where oil is today, but I know we're a heck of a lot closer to 30 than we are to 80. That's for sure. So if you can get some oil stocks that can pay a great dividend, that you know, you don't want to mess with the shale group because there's a chance they go bust. But there's a lot of producers out there that, regardless of what happens over the next 2, 3, 4 years, they're going to still be in business. There's a lot of producers, not a lot, but a few producers outside of the United States that I think are very interesting. And that's me just reiterating what I've learned from Lynn Alden in a lot of our conversations in Rebel Capitalist Pro. She likes Luke Oil as an example. So, yeah, I definitely like the oil producers right now, but I like them better when oil is under 30. So I bought a lot back in March. I'm happy to keep that. And hopefully we'll get the price to go down further so I can buy more. Is now a good time to buy GDX? Well, I don't like GDX. I don't like them because the custodian is HSBC. And I don't know, I just don't like that counterparty risk. I may be too much of a tinfoil hatter on that, but I like Rick. Rick's a good friend, and I know Rick's a straight shooter and a good dude, Rick Rule, and so I much prefer to buy Sprott than the GDX. As far as now being a good time, I don't think I can answer that for you. I think, for me personally, I think every time or any time is a good time to buy gold, because I don't really look at the price. I just make sure that it's 10% of my portfolio to make sure I'm maintaining my purchasing power. So you know, if you're looking at gold as more of a speculation, then it's different. But for me, it's not a speculation. It's just simply insurance policy, as I've said on this channel many, many times. So with Sprott as an example, you know, like right now, I'm traveling so much. I'm in Georgia today. Just since COVID's hit, I've been in Medellin, Fort Lauderdale, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, St. Barts, Las Vegas, and now Phoenix, now Jekyll Island. So I haven't had the opportunity to take a lot of physical gold. So for me, in the interim, I'm just buying Sprott. Their physical gold fund or trust, PHYS. So going back to your question, you got to look at a chart of gold adjusted for inflation. But then with gold, I think you really have to layer over M2 money supply. And this is another thing that Lynn and I have been discussing a lot in Rebel Capitalist Pro, that you know, back when gold hit its peak in 2011 or so, the money supply was, I don't know right off the top of my head, but let's say it was 10 trillion. And now it's at the same level in nominal terms, the price of gold, let's call it 1900. But the M2 money supply, if you believe the Fed, has gone from 10 trillion up to 18 trillion. So the money supply has almost doubled, but the gold price is still the same. So I think that you have to start with that inflation adjusted chart, but then you have to layer over how many currency units have been created in the interim that are able to get out there and chase that bar of gold. And so on that metric, I think it could be considered cheap. Definitely a lot cheaper than 2011, that's for sure. But again, I don't really focus too much on that because I don't see gold as a speculation. I don't see it as an investment. I see it as a store of value and just insurance policy. Gold miners, different. I see them as a speculation. So I'd be more hyper-focused on cheap and expensive if I'm looking at the gold miners or silver miners. Can you explain your optimism for copper and any mines you're interested in? I don't know any specifics on that. That's really Chris McIntosh, his area of expertise. He's the other pro I have in Rebel Capitalist Pro, along with Lynn Alden. But, you know, copper, number one, is cheap. Dr. Copper is telling us that the economy is not going to be doing well. But so historically, it's cheap, but you've got a lot of tailwind there. Man, you got a lot of tailwind in the sense that if California, let's say, bans gas-powered cars by, 2035, Gavin Newsom said, and he's just such a clown, but he was talking about 2035. So that means that you've got this whole move toward electric vehicles. So I'm not here to debate the, you know, electric vehicles, but if that's the case, if we go that direction, you're going to need a ton of copper. In fact, Chris did a study, I know, or he referenced a study that actually did the math on how much copper you would need to create that many electric vehicles. And it's like, I don't know what it was, but it was something outrageous, like 10 times the amount of copper that we use or have right now. So demand would just go through the roof if you believe that narrative and if you think that's the direction we're going. So, and then you've got the stagflation tailwind that if we do see the 1970s play out, which I think is a high probability if the system changes and the Federal Reserve just completely ignores the Federal Reserve Act, which I think they're more than happy to do. I think that March and April have shown us how willing they are to completely ignore the law and the spirit of the law, by the way, and just do what they think needs to be done in order to prop up the asset bubbles, the everything bubble, because they know how important that is to the consumer and how, therefore how important it is to the overall economy. So, you know, that means a lot of money printing, and that means trying to get M2 money supply up along with velocity. Now, whether they can do it or not, a lot of people would argue they can't because you look at Japan. But I'm someone that argues that they probably learned from the Japanese experience and the European experience, and they're going to print enough money to get it done. That's what I think long term. So that would also be a huge tailwind to copper. So if you believe that the Fed is going to continue to just print crazy amounts of money and do QE infinity forever, and that they're somehow going to circumvent the transfer mechanism of the commercial banking system. So in other words, as Dr. Lacey Hunt would say, turn bank reserves into legal tender. I think that's what they'll do. And then, or if you believe that the future is going to be electric vehicles, then I think you got to be bullish copper. And it's cheap. If the dollar gets removed from the SDR, that means that the currency will revalue and imported products will go up in price. I don't know about that. What do you think? I don't know, Mauricio. I've heard people, especially here at this conference, talk about the dollar potentially being removed from the basket of currencies that makes up the SDR. But if it is, I don't know that everyone that holds dollars just sells them just because they're not in the SDR. And plus, I don't see that happening. I don't see them. I mean, it's a world reserve currency at the end of the day. And I don't see them taking it out of the SDR. So I don't know that that would be a very high probability at all. And even if they did, I don't know that that would make it instantly revalue. There's so much dollar denominated debt out there. And by definition, that's demand for dollars, regardless of whether it's in the SDR or not. Yeah, I just don't know that that would make a big difference. So I think it's a neat question for sure. It's a cool thought experiment, but I wouldn't spend too much time on it. I think there's a bigger fish we have to fry right now for sure. Okay, if interest rates go negative, then wouldn't banks profit just by borrowing money from M0? Get paid for taking loans? No. Mm-mm. No, because you got to think about, Jordan, you have to think about how so what you're doing is you're thinking about the liability side of the commercial banking system's balance sheet. So you're thinking that they take rates negative, so that means that the people who have deposits at the bank have to pay to have those deposits. That's true, but you're not thinking about the how do they get the rates negative in the first place. Right, they would have to take IOER, which is interest on excess reserves. The Federal Reserve would. They'd have to take those negative. So that means that all the reserves that the commercial banks have to back up the new loans they create, they'd have to pay to hold those at the Fed, right? Because the rates are negative. So right now they're getting paid on excess reserves. Maybe it's 10 basis points or something, but they would have to actually pay the Fed to hold those reserves, and then they would lend that money out, and then they'd have to pay to lend the money out. See, so I mean, it just completely destroys the commercial banking system, period. And you say, well, then they just take the rates negative on the depositors. Well, okay, at what point do the depositors start taking out their money? And that game, you can only play that game so long. And I don't think they can really take them that far negative. So if you had this situation where the deposit rate was, let's say, negative 1%, so yes, that is a profit stream or a revenue stream to the banks, or now it's an expense, then their loans, which is now their profit stream, and IOER, which is their revenue stream, that goes negative. So now those become an expense. So basically, you're trading one expense and two revenue streams for two expenses and one revenue stream. And that's assuming that you could take rates negative on deposits, which I don't know that you could. Maybe a couple basis points, but once you start getting down into 2% and 3%, I don't know. I think people start yanking their money out. So my point is, the negative interest rates would crush the banking system. The banks that would benefit or potentially benefit from negative interest rates would be banks that are not involved in retail lending. So JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, the banks that make all their money from trading and just being financial insiders and financial engineering, those are the banks that might do well. But Wells Fargo, a B of A, and something like that, they're going to get smoked.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capital's Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
What is your opinion on high yield bonds? Do you believe investors will buy if Fed? So I think you're kind of looking at it the wrong way, Marios, because you're trying to start with deciding whether or not the price is going to go up or down. And I don't like to start from that point. I like to start from the standpoint of asking myself if it's cheap or if it's expensive. And we all know that interest rates are at 5,000 year lows. And there's an inverse relationship between interest rates and the price of a bond or the price of a treasury. So if interest rates are at 5,000 year lows, that means the prices of bonds are at 5,000 year highs. And if they're at 5,000 year highs, there's nothing cheap about that. So I'm not saying that bonds couldn't increase in value. Sure, just like the stock market. But I do know that they're not cheap right now. They're wildly expensive. And therefore, I don't want anything to do with them. So I don't even worry about if whether or not the price is going to go up or down, because I've the first thing that I need to check off the box to continue my analysis on whether or not I want to buy the asset, I can't check that off. So I don't spend any time on it. Now, as a thought experiment, then let me try to think that through. So what's your opinion on high yield? Do you believe investors buy if Fed apply negative interest rates? Just because the Fed tries to go negative, it doesn't necessarily mean that corporate debt goes negative. It just means that the value potentially or most likely goes up because the interest rates are going down. Assuming they go down, I mean, there's always a risk premium that the market puts on. I think you've got more tailwind there with the Fed basically showing their cards, saying, hey, if the junk bond market or if the debt market in general, if it goes down, we're going to step in and be the buyer of not only last resort, but the buyer of first resort and second, third, and fourth resort. We're going to buy everything, just like JGBs in the Bank of Japan. So I think that's your tailwind. But again, I'm not interested. I have no interest in buying that whatsoever, because I don't care how much tailwind I think the Fed is going to provide by printing bank reserves and hiring BlackRock to go in there and buy these things through some bogus special purpose vehicle, through some scam of a shell game. I just answer that first question. And if it's no, then is it cheap? Then I just move on. So, question, purchasing power being in effect power, could the, I don't know about that. I don't know. I hesitate with that one. But let's keep going here. Oh, I lost it. Could the reallocation and increase of said purchasing power in the hands of specific people be more micromanagement? I think you're trying to say virtuous or fortuitous. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that all of the purchasing power should be in very few hands. And I think in a free market economy, it won't be. You're always going to have the haves and the have-nots, that we can't get away from that. We're all human beings and we have different skill sets. And so in a free market capitalist society, which I think is superior, you're going to have fewer poor people overall, but you're still going to have some rich people. And that's, you know, I think focusing on a wealth gap, I don't think is it's interesting thought experiment, but I don't think it's a real good use of people's time, because we really shouldn't be focusing on the wealth gap. We should be focusing on the standard of living of the people in the poor and middle class. And as long as their standard of living is improving, then who cares what the rich are doing? See, the socialists like to believe that that's a fixed pie. And if the rich are getting richer, then by definition, the poor are getting poorer. But I don't believe that. I don't think that's, if you look at how things have played out, that I don't think the data would back that up at all. Yeah, I don't think that's a good thing. But again, I think if we just allow the free market to work, then it will be increasing the standard of living for the poor and middle class at a rate that's the fastest rate we can achieve, based on the fact that we're all flawed human beings living in a flawed and imperfect world. Question: with deflation coming in massive shorts in the long bond by speculators, is investment in long bond a good idea? No, Michael. I can't give you personal investment advice. All I can do is just tell you what I'm doing, or how I see things, or what I would suggest to my friends and family. And there's nothing about bonds, any bonds, short, long, I don't care where it is on the yield curve. there's nothing about it that's cheap. It's all expensive, wildly expensive. So if it's wildly expensive, I just wouldn't worry about if the price is going to go up. It's off the table for me once I determine that it isn't cheap. Okay, hey George, how do you differentiate between things being cheap and just being garbage, like Deutsche? Well, that's when you're analyzing specific companies. That's when you've got to do a lot of fundamental analysis. When I say things are cheap, a lot of times I'm just talking very broad strokes. So I like sectors, as an example, or the stock market or the real estate market. I'm not talking about individual houses or individual stocks. And, oil is a great example of that. I always say, well, oil is cheap right now, or getting cheaper when it's under $30 a barrel. And that's true, but it doesn't necessarily mean that a shale producer is cheap, just because they're producing the underlying commodity, which I think has good value, right? That's where you've got to be a Warren Buffett or a Benjamin Graham, and you've got to look at the P&L, you've got to look at the balance sheet, and you've got to figure out if this company has solid fundamentals. And just another thing that people like Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh are genius at doing that. That's their profession. That there's no better two people in the business, in my opinion, of fundamental analysis than Lynn and Chris McIntosh. So that's why I'm so proud to partner up with them. But that's really the bottom line. You got to start with the underlying asset. If it's real estate, if it's commodities, then if it's the stock market, and then if it is whichever asset class you think is cheap, then you've got to go in and put on your fundamental analysis hat and start looking at the individual companies. What are your top income producing assets other than real estate? What areas, industries are you keeping an eye on? Coal is my top income producing asset outside of real estate. Other than, I think education is my top producing asset for sure. The education that I've had, self-taught education from guys like Mike Maloney and Rickards and Schiff and Mark Faber and Jim Rogers and, even Buffett and Druckenmiller and just trying to study and analyze the greats, whether they're kind of Austrian or not. I think that's the best income producing asset that I have is my brain. That's what my father always used to say. He's like, the government can take whatever they want to, but they can never take this. And he says, as long as I have this, I don't have to worry about anything else. And so that's what I would try to focus on for sure. But to answer your question specifically, it would be the coal producers that I own, that I purchased back in March. Those have the highest dividend. I think when I bought them, it was like a 17% dividend. The stocks have gone up substantially since then. So now the dividend is only, quote unquote, maybe like 13 or 14%. Now, will they pay the dividend? There's always a risk they don't pay the dividend. But I mean, the stock's gone up 30 or 40% since I've purchased them. I mean, it looks pretty good, right? The oil producers that I purchased, those dividends were right around 10%. My memory serves me right around 10%. So that would be a good source of income. You know, my the stocks I bought way back in 2013, those now pay a fantastic dividend. Well, the stocks I bought in Cyprus when they did the bail-in. And, you know, I've always said that the best investments I've ever had is when everyone around me, my friends and family, have told me that I'm absolutely crazy. And everyone, even outside of my friends and family members, were telling me I was crazy to go in and buy in Cyprus when they did the bail-in. And I made a lot of money on that. Same thing with Colombian real estate. Everyone's telling you that you're crazy. That's where you make all the money. So that's kind of my first gauge as to whether or not I'm interested in buying something. Is if I tell other people about it and they tell me I'm crazy, I get more bullish. If I tell other people about it, the idea, and they think that's great and they want to invest in it as well, then I start to get more bearish. There are more old people exiting the economy than younger generation to replace them. Isn't that having an effect on banking sector? So how much? Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a huge deflationary pressure right there, Danny, and that's a great point. And also, it's a lot of downward pressure on the economy overall because you have that purchasing power and the wealthiest generation of Americans reducing the amount of spending and reducing the productivity. And, you know, how does that play out? I mean, Danielle DiMartino Booth has an interesting theory. And I spoke with her about this when I interviewed her a couple months ago. I got to get Danielle back on too. But she was talking about if, you know, this and back then the economy was really collapsing. But assuming that we continue through this recession, which I think we'll be in for quite a while, whether it's an inflationary recession or a deflationary recession, that's up to debate. But assuming that we stay in this recession quite a while, you know, the baby boomers, they might not have that pension. And look at the pension crisis we have right now in the United States. They're all underfunded. It's just to what degree those pensions are underfunded. So those baby boomers that are accounting on that and Social Security, if we have some steep inflation, then all of a sudden they're getting those Social Security checks. Those are just nominal dollars, so their purchasing power is going down. She says, but they have a lot of home equity, but they might be forced to sell just to have money to pay the bills and maintain their standard of living. And if that's the case, what happens to real estate? There's a lot of knock-on effects there, is my point, to the baby boomers being this glut of the population that is also the wealthiest. And created a lot of productivity. You know, what happens if they are exiting at the same time that housing prices are going down in nominal terms and the stock market is going down and interest rates are going up? So their risk parity portfolio, the 40-60 that all their financial advisors put them into, maybe that gets a 50% haircut. You know, how does that affect spending? There's a lot of, and I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just saying that it's definitely a probability, and it's something that we need to think through and that we need to attach a probability to because it's a huge economic driver. And I think it's going to be a big factor. So great question. I think more what affects the banking system, the system potentially, is the younger generation being so laden with student loan debt that they're not able to have enough disposable income to take out the additional car loan, to take out the additional home loan. So I think that would probably have more to do with it than just kind of a more people exiting and fewer people coming in type of situation. So yeah, I guess you do have less population, so fewer loans. And then in addition to that, the generation coming in or the fewer people coming in have less purchasing power to take out loans in the first place. So yeah, I guess that could definitely affect the retail banking system.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Where can I learn to buy real estate around the world? Nowhere. Honestly, you can't learn anywhere. You can learn how to buy real estate, or you can learn about real estate on podcasts like my buddy Jason Hartman with the Creating Wealth Show, the Bigger Pockets podcast. I think it's fantastic. The Real Estate Guys, their podcast. I just actually met them yesterday, and they were nice enough to invite me on in the future. So I'm looking forward to doing that. But those are really the three main podcasts that I listened to when I first got involved with real estate back in 2012. And I'd suggest everyone listen to those if they're interested in real estate. But although that will teach you the basics and it'll teach you how to think about real estate, it doesn't give you the boots on the ground experience that you need to be successful in a different country. You know, I always talk about how great of an opportunity Colombian real estate is, and I've made a lot of money there since 2015. That said, if you go down there as a gringo with no experience, you're going to get crushed. You're going to lose a lot of money. You may get lucky, but the odds are you're going to get crushed. It's just because you don't have that local expertise. You got to be an expert. And so the only way you become an expert is you just have to hop on a plane and go there. There's no other alternative for it. None. So if you're interested, that's just why I was going to Dubai. You know, I, as most of you know, I had to stop over in Phoenix, and I'll be there for a couple months. But the plan was to go from Puerto Rico to Dubai, specifically to look at real estate. And so I wasn't going to try to figure out the Dubai real estate market just by going to a website or reading a book or a podcast or some guy named George Gammon's YouTube channel. I was going to go there and check it out. You got to be there and look at it. You got to look at the taxi drivers. You got to talk to the Uber drivers. You got to talk to the bartenders, to the waitresses. You got to look at the mall. You got to see how people are spending money. It's just, you got to get a sense for it. You have to just absorb as much information as you possibly can. And you got to do it for 2, 3, 4 weeks. And that's so, if you know what you're doing. If you don't, you got to be there for months and months to figure this stuff out. And it's why you have an edge. If it was easy, everyone would be doing it. So that's the best advice I can give you to understand the real estate game. Listen to the Bigger Pockets podcast, Creating Wealth Show with my buddy Jason Hartman and the Real Estate Guys. And but to actually pull the trigger in another market, you're going to have to go there physically. What are the economics behind the economy not being able to handle higher interest rates? Which rates? Well, I don't know. I'm trying to think of rates that could go up without crushing the economy. I don't know. I mean, I don't think mortgage rates could go up without crushing the housing market. I mean, and we say up. I mean, what is up? At 10 basis points, that's not going to crush the housing market. When people say going up, the first thing that I think of in my mind is rates going back to normal. And so what is normal? Normal is where they've been for the last 200 years. So that means the Fed funds at, call it 5%. That would mean mortgage rates at 8, 9%. And those numbers sound laughable right now. They seem impossible. But we have to realize that just a few years ago, that was normal. And it has been for 200 plus years. So, I mean, go back to the 1800s, for heaven's sakes. Look at what the interest rates were. So it's not like we don't have a long history of data. It's not like we don't have a very big data pool on interest rates. It goes back a long, long time. So again, when I hear interest rates going up, I think of just normalizing. So let's think through the sovereign debt. The U.S. government rolls over. I mean, I was talking to Luke Grohman, not the other day, but in one of our past interviews. You know, Luke's a great buddy and a brilliant, brilliant guy. And he was talking about that in 2019, the government had to roll over almost $11 trillion in debt. $11 trillion. So many people look at the $27 trillion the government owes and think it's like a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. It's not. It's not. A lot of that's very short-term debt that they have to roll over. So if interest rates go up, they've got to roll over all that debt at a higher interest rate. And right now, I would say the average interest rate they're paying on the $27 trillion is sub 2%. So what happens if that goes to 5-6? Now, all of a sudden, the government, they can't pay the bills unless just the Fed monetizes more and more of the debt, which obviously they do. But that becomes a huge issue. Corporate debt. Look at what happened that the Fed had to come in and buy all the junk bonds and through the special purpose vehicles and the corporate debt. Because why? Because corporate debt is at an all-time high, and those rates readjust when they have to roll them over. They don't have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. So when those rates roll over, it crushes profits. It crushes the stock market. It brings the stocks down in price, which then crushes the economy because the whole economy is built on asset prices. So it's this domino effect. It's this house of cards that is all built on artificially low interest rates, all the way from the sovereign level down to the consumer level. How can we implement libertarian thought into our education system? Like, you got to homeschool. I don't know how else you're going to do it, because especially, you know, I'm here at this Red Pill Conference or Red Pill Expo that is put on by Mr. Griffin. And a lot of these people are homeschooling, but you hear the stories of what these kids are dealing with in the public school systems. And it's just utter nonsense. They're just being completely brainwashed to buy into this Marxist narrative and a narrative of central planning and basically that the government needs to protect us and that we need to... The government is in charge of our safety. The government should be giving us a job. The government should be giving us health care. All we need to do is just, just sit there on the couch like some sort of, you know, like we're comatose or something. And just this blob that's just, it's like the Matrix, you know, we're just plugged into the system and all we do is live in these bubbles and the government provides everything for us. And we just get lazy and fat. That's not what I'm all about. I'm about the opposite of that, about self-reliance and resiliency and not needing the government. And if that means that I don't have a job, and if that means I take increased risk with my personal safety, so be it. I'll take the risk. Thank you very much. So... my point is, unfortunately, in the United States especially, I think the school system is going the complete opposite direction. And therefore, the only way to do this, I think, would be to homeschool. George, what are your thoughts on MMT? I think they get a few things right. I think that their description is somewhat correct. I would dispute that it's not completely correct. I don't know that the government spends money into existence. I think the MMT crew have a hard time explaining the TGA. And I think they also have a hard time explaining the Euro dollar system, because their whole thing is that the U.S. government is the issuer of the currency. It's a currency issuer, not a currency user or a currency taker. And I don't know how you reconcile the Euro dollar system with that idea, nor do I know how you reconcile the TGA. I think the MMTers that I've talked to that understand the TGA to say, oh, well, that's just there for show. Okay, I guess. And another thing I don't think they can understand or that they can explain is how the repo market would function, how the dollar funding markets would function without sovereign debt. That I don't think they've crossed that bridge. But there's a lot of things that I think where their description of the system is correct. And I think they understand that the commercial banking system is responsible for creating and destroying the majority of the money supply, or at least it was prior to 2008. And so they get that. Where I really disagree with them, though, are their policy prescriptions. And I understand that a lot of them aren't giving prescriptions, but the ones that do, I don't like those, because they just see excess capacity in the economy and assume that you can fill that excess capacity with government spending. And it's just magically we're going to be at full unemployment and we're all going to live in this utopia until we get inflation. And then all you have to do is just increase taxes, and then that sucks liquidity out of the system, and bam, your inflation problem is solved. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. And I would encourage the MMTers that have that policy prescription just to look at tax receipts as a percentage of GDP. And you see that you can increase taxes to 80, 90%. Doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to pay them. So back, if you look at the tax receipts compared to GDP, going back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, I mean, we had rates as high as 90%, all the way down to maybe 25% in the Reagan era. And if you look at the amount of money that we collect relative to GDP, it's pretty much the exact same. So you're going to have a real tough time pulling in inflation exclusively through taxes. And then I think you're really going to have a hard time creating additional goods and services through government spending. Because see, when they say that there's excess capacity in the economy, that therefore you can print money and not create inflation, they would readily admit that if you do create more currency units, then you're creating goods and services, that you are going to see consumer price inflation. They just argue that the government can create these jobs and create the amount of goods and services required to keep up with the amount of money printing. And I would argue that that's not going to happen in real life. It's great in paper. It works in a textbook. But as a math equation, it works. But in the world of imperfect human beings, in an imperfect world, it's not going to work. I mean, how many of you think that the government could be in charge of producing the stuff at Walmart or Home Depot? And they could do that at a rate that would keep up with trillions and trillions of dollars of money printing. You know, I'm not going to roll the dice on that, especially if the downside is you've got to jack taxes to 90%. I think about that. What if we go through, see, this is what they never consider, right? They assume that they go back to the Phillips curve, where they think that if you get unemployment down to a certain level, that you're going to have inflation. And that once unemployment gets higher, then, you know, the inflation goes down. It's the same Phillips curve nonsense that was debunked back in the 1970s. So, or said another way, that if you have higher economic output, then that's going to result in inflation. But you could have higher nominal output or higher nominal prices. That creates higher nominal GDP, and that doesn't necessarily mean that the economy is richer. So, you know, what would have happened in the 1970s when we had probably negative real GDP, yet we had inflation? What would have happened back then if you would have jacked rates from jacked tax rates from 30 or 40% up to 90? You would have completely crushed the economy, even worse. So there's just, again, I think they've got some, they've got some good descriptions for sure. And they're very smart people. And I've got a lot of respect for Kelton and Mosler. But as far as their prescriptions or some of the MMTers prescriptions, I don't like those. And I don't think that they're thinking through the TGA. I don't think they're thinking through the Euro dollar system. And I don't think they're really comprehending how sovereign debt is used as collateral in the dollar funding markets and what the lack of sovereign debt or the lack of pristine collateral, to use Jeff Snyder's words, would do to the entire global economy, meaning it would collapse it. Would you say that we're in a free market economy? Not even close, my friend, not even close. Or in a totally managed economy behind the thin curtain, apparent freedom of enterprise. Yeah, I think that just you say something over and over again and people just assume that it's true. So in the United States, we've heard that we practice free market capitalism over and over and over and over and over and over again. So we just assume that it's true. Listen, there's nothing free market about the Fed coming in and bailing out the banking system in 2008. That's not a free market. That's not capitalism. That's not a free market. Like Milton Friedman always says, the most important part of capitalism is not necessarily the profit, more so the loss. It's the loss. It's Schumpeter's creative destruction. That's what you have to have. And we've completely omitted that from the equation. We meaning the government and the Fed. So, I mean, look at what we're doing. We're bailing out American Airlines. We're bailing out Boeing. We're doing PPP. We're doing this and that and the other. That's the furthest thing from a free market possible. We've got to realize, see, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to have a free market without any of the downside or without any of the loss, without any of the businesses going out of business. And what they don't realize is the strength in a free market or in capitalism long term is because the businesses go out of business and the prudent and the better entrepreneurs take over the assets and they make the whole thing stronger. It's very similar to how evolution works in nature. And if you don't allow that process, if you don't allow the system to flush, what's the cure for the economy? It's a recession. The recession shouldn't be avoided. It should be seen as a necessary evil to increase the strength of the economy for future generations. It's the recession is the cure. And unfortunately, that's what we're trying to completely avoid at all costs by making the overall economy worse and worse and worse. And at some point, you've got to pay the fiddler. Do you think the West has bailed out these industries so China doesn't come in and buy it all after the funny money as a matter of national security? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, it's an interesting hypothesis. I think that it's more so about them understanding that the U.S. economy and the developed world really, but more so the U.S., is built on asset bubbles, confidence, and debt. And I think that's their first priority. Then down the line, they're probably thinking to themselves, okay, well, if we can bail out all these companies that we have to bail out anyway, so we don't allow asset prices to go down, the fringe benefit to that might be that the Chinese don't come in and buy all the assets. I think that may be a knock-on effect, kind of icing on the cake, if you want to say it that way. But I don't know that that's their first priority. Okay, guys. Well, I think I've got to get out to lunch, and I've got to take some more pictures and do some more media and all that fun stuff. So I really appreciate you being on. It was kind of an impromptu live stream because we couldn't do it at the normal time today. So next week, we should be right back on schedule. Make sure you're checking out Rebel Capitalist Pro. You guys are going to absolutely love it. Going into the election with commodities cheap, with the everything bubble, with quantitative easing, there's no better time to surround yourself with like-minded investors and pros like Lynn Alden, Chris McIntosh, and amateurs like myself to make sure that your portfolio is positioned as well as it can be for whatever comes down the pipeline in the next weeks or months or years to come. So check that out at georgehammond.com/pro. And let me give some shout outs to everyone that is here. And we got a lot of people today. Maybe I should do them during this time. With almost 1,100, 1,200 people. That's a great turnout. So thanks for being here, guys. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Big Hill, Marios. And if you guys notice, I'm trying to keep my voice down a little bit here today. I don't have my typical energy like I do when I'm in my office. Valerie, is it Hiki Nabi? Silas, Brandon, Little Abu, Mary, Isaac, Monica, Stephen, Aurora, Bloodbath McGrath, okay, The Boss Man, CC Machine, Hunter Shoemaker, A Big Hill, Kevin Glick, Atlas Shrugs, Frank Me, CC, Hank, Richard, Silas, Stephen, Fatal, King, K, Ya, Heat. Guys, I sincerely appreciate you being here, and we'll see you guys on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.